today, we continue our series on the opioid crisis in Illinois by taking you inside the treatment and recovery process.
Because I could sugarcoat it and tell myself it's not that bad. And, you know, I could quit. I don't really need to. I could do it on my own. But really, the fact of the matter is I need help, and I cannot do it alone.
That's Sam Workmeister. We'll hear his story and talk to experts on addiction during this hour. But first, we're taking a look at healthcare inside Illinois' prison system. A judge has just approved an ACLU lawsuit to be a class action. We'll ask one of their lawyers why they believe medical care at state prisons is so poor that it's unconstitutional. And one man who was formerly incarcerated shares his story with us. I'm trying to get treatment while in prison. As always, you're welcome to join us with your questions and comments. Tweet us at 21STShow or give us a call at 1-800-222-9455. And we'll start that conversation in just a few minutes after this news update. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Getting quality health care can be hard enough for everyday people, but for the more than 49,000 people in Illinois prisons, that process can be even tougher. 2 years ago, a team of court-approved researchers went to 8 prisons across the state and reported widespread problems that included major backlogs and delays in treatment. The ACLU of Illinois has since sued the Department of Corrections on behalf of several inmates, saying that standards of medical care at state prisons is so poor that it's unconstitutional. And last month, a judge approved that as a class action, and the results could force the Department of Corrections to overhaul care at dozens of facilities. In a few minutes, we're going to be talking with one of ACLU's staff attorneys. But first, joining us on the line now to share his story is someone who's experienced this firsthand, Roosevelt Burrell. Roosevelt, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being with me.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me.
I appreciate you being willing to share your story with us, Roosevelt. I know you were incarcerated from 1987 to 2011. During that time, what kind of sicknesses and injuries happen to you? Did you suffer from?
Well, actually, there was numerous, you know, numerous, like so many other who are presently incarcerated. Mines were from headaches to accidentally being sprayed in the face with a mace or CS spray to dislocation, shoulder dislocation, kidney problems, you know, you name it, you know.
And when you had something, for example, like kidney problems, what was the process like trying to get treatment? Did you have to fill out a form? Did you talk to someone?
The first thing that you would do, you would fill out a form. You could talk to or try to talk to someone since it's of urgency. But unfortunately, you know, no one would actually hear you, and they would tell you, you know, to file a sick call slip. And the sick call slip would take anywhere from forever, you know. I mean, you know, it's supposed to take a matter of days, you know, for them to see you. But
and when you say forever, you know, then how long would it take? Would it take weeks?
Well, sometimes they, you know, they're lost in the mail. You know, most of the time,
so you have to put it in the mail if you would like to request. You have to mail something to someone saying I need medical help.
Yes, you would mail it to the department, to an external part of the facility, and. And they're supposed to get it. They're supposed to receive it, which sometimes they never do, as I said. And so many times, you know, this lead to people putting in more slips to try to address the, you know, an issue, you know, which sometimes never go, you know, addressed.
I'm speaking to Roosevelt Burrell. We're talking about his experience receiving health care while he was incarcerated. We're talking about this because of an ACLU lawsuit on behalf of several inmates to the Illinois Department of Corrections. We did reach out to the Department of Corrections. They responded as saying that, quote, outside of court filings, the department has nothing to add about health care in its facilities, end quote. Although state lawyers have argued that the inmates in the ACL lawsuit indeed have gotten adequate care. And I want to bring someone else into this conversation. In studio with us here at the Middle Newsrooms in downtown Chicago is Lindsay Miller. She's a staff attorney with the ACLU of Illinois. Lindsay, thanks for being here with me.
Thank you for having me.
As you're listening to Roosevelt's story, is that fairly typical? Is that the process that if inmates even now, so that was back in 2011, inmates have to put in, like, you have to send something through the mail if you need health care?
Inmates do have to submit a sick call slip, and often it's through institutional mail. And the process that Roosevelt is describing is very typical of what we've heard. The entire system is disorganized. There's chaos, and with maintaining documents and things get lost. I'm not surprised to hear that this was his experience at all.
And Roosevelt, how many requests did you say that you would have ended up sending over your period of incarceration? Do you even know?
Over my period of incarceration, I don't have an idea.
Wow.
Because, and like I said, I had a few injuries.
And when you didn't hear anything, what kind of things did you do on your own to try to feel better?
Well, one thing I would do would be to try to meditate, to try to escape the pain, you know. So pain is common among a lot of people, you know, a lot of the people that's incarcerated, you know what I mean, because there's very little that or anything that they would do anyway, you know, to help you, you know. For instance, I had a dislocated shoulder while incarcerated, and the first thing that I was told to do was, after a long period of time, I mean, this
one.
Did
you mean weeks or months? Did you say six
no,
months?
This was 6 months. This was from August, probably longer. This is from August of 2005 until April, I believe, April of 2006. And so I could not sleep at all. I couldn't sleep. I couldn't.
And could
get
you
any
have
rest.
Roosevelt? Did you get? Are you able to get things like Tylenol or pain medication? How were things? Were those things available to you when you were incarcerated?
The magic bullet that they use in prison is ibuprofen. They give
okay,
you
and that and you
everything.
Were at that at least you had ibuprofen. It sounds like
that was after what? After probably three to four months.
Of asking for it?
Yes.
So it took 3 to 4 months for you to get ibuprofen?
Yes.
Wow. So just to be clear, Roosevelt, you're not involved in this specific lawsuit, Lindsay, that the ACLU has filed. Lindsay, can you tell us about some of the experiences involved with those clients involved with medical care? Is it similar to what Roosevelt is sharing with us?
It's absolutely very similar. And the delays in care and treatment that Roosevelt is talking about are exactly the sorts of things our clients have experienced. And needing to find other ways to kind of alleviate pain that clients have to do for themselves because the department isn't being responsive. We have one client who not too long ago had a very severe tooth infection and was told that it needed to be extracted. And after weeks of waiting, because of backlogs, this extraction couldn't get scheduled, so the client had to remove his own tooth.
And this is, I imagine, why you're saying that medical care doesn't meet constitutional standards. Can you explain that a little bit? What in particular is, I mean, I think from a logical standpoint, it sounds like, yes, if someone has to remove their own tooth, that doesn't seem like that meets kind of a constitutional standard. But legally, what does that mean?
Yeah. And you know, there are many ways to describe it. And I think common sense is probably the best way to think about it. Prison officials are required to provide adequate care to those in their custody. And Illinois just has not met that standard, as Roosevelt is indicating, for a long time. So if you're hearing about a delay and it sounds excessive in your personal life, chances are it's not meeting constitutional standards. We have another client who has torn nearly all of the ligaments in her knee and has been told by an outside doctor that she requires a total knee replacement, and that was 5 years ago, and she hasn't received this procedure. And the department has only been able to provide things like ibuprofen or physical therapy, which at her stage, it's not going to be helpful. So when you're hearing about delays this long and treatment this minimal, you can be sure that it's not meeting constitutional standards.
And can you give us a sense, Lindsay, of how widespread this problem is within the prison system in Illinois? How many people are facing healthcare problems? Certainly, we haven't even begun to talk about substance abuse all this week, as we've been later on in the hour. We are going to be going back to our week-long series we're doing about on opioid and opioid addiction. Certainly, we've always heard that the prison system is in some ways the largest substance abuse provider or counselor in the state. But just I wonder if we're, even apart from just maybe substance abuse issues, if we can talk about health care in general, health and mental care in general. Can you give us a sense of how many people are needing care within our prison system?
Sure. Well, it's broadly accepted that prisoners on the whole across the nation have greater health care needs than the general population. I think some recent numbers have said prisoners on average, about 50% of them have suffer from at least one chronic illness. Compared to the general population, it's closer to 30%. Illinois in particular also has a very rapidly aging population of prisoners. We're in the top 10 nationwide of prisoners over the age of 55. And understandably, the older you get, the more likely you are to have serious health needs. Illinois is also, we over incarcerate in Illinois. The prison system was originally designed to hold 32,000 inmates, and currently we're around 44,000, and in very recent years we're up near 50,000. So the healthcare demands on the system are quite substantial.
Roosevelt, was your experience when you were incarcerated that this, what Lindsay's saying, were there lots of other inmates alongside you that also had chronic health problems?
I mean, it was common, you know, to hear of someone, you know, with some very serious, issues that they were facing. You know, me myself, I believe that when we while we were in Tams, I was in Tams closed Supermax during this time, and there were so many guys, there were so many prisoners who were in pain, you know, constantly around you, that it was almost normal, you know, to hear someone, you know, complaining about trying to get some type of relief, trying to get to the doctor's office who was, you know, really a joke and to many of us, because he was he never did anything for anyone. You know, you would go to the doctor's office and say that.
So you could go to the doctor's office. I guess it would be a process, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. After a long period of time, when they saw me, the first thing he wanted to do was, you know, I tell him that my shoulder, my shoulder was dislocated. I told him how it happened, and he wanted to look at my scrotum. You know, I mean, what is the relationship between the two? You know, you want to look at my foot, or you want to look at, you know, an area that's unrelated, you know, and I'm telling you that I'm in this great amount of pain. I'm in such pain that I can't, you know, bear it.
Can I ask you one last question, Roosevelt? You now have been out of prison. You served your time. You have been out for 6 years. Has your health gotten better since then?
Well, unfortunately not. You know, along with the numerous issues that I had coming from the prison system, I was, not long ago, I was in a car wreck, so.
I'm sorry to hear that.
I battled some things from that, too, but, you know, so I'm still, you know, going through my shoulder, different shoulder pains. My kidneys now have, from prison, my kidneys have multiple cysts, you know, build up around them. And that's another thing that while I was in prison, I turned orange. after a while, which caused my family, you know, to, when they came to see me, they stopped coming to see me because they couldn't bear to see me in the condition that I was in. So this was a thing for a lot of people in prison that went through the same thing, you know, that their family would come and see them, you know, suffering the way that we were suffering, and they would stop. A lot of them couldn't take it. So, you know.
Well, Roosevelt, thank you. I appreciate you sharing a little bit of our story. Lindsay, we just have about a minute or so before the break, but the class action suit that the ACLU has would force the Department of Corrections to change its medical care system at many of its facilities. I wonder if just before the break, I know you probably won't have time to answer all of it, but what kind of changes do you think need to be made?
So we want them, they need to make changes on a broad scale. And I think the way to think about it is to start from the top down. The department needs to invest in strong, stable leadership, in training their professionals, in making sure that these professionals can provide clinical guidance and oversight so that it continues over time, that it's not just a Band-Aid, that you're really investing in having quality professionals performing this work. Vacancies need to be filled with the backlogs that we've talked about, the delays in care. These vacancies have existed in facilities for a very long time. There needs to be a priority in filling those. And there needs to be significant effort put forward in rewriting policies that are outdated, that don't meet current standards of care, such as with chronic clinic care and infirmary care. These are kind of the first steps in creating a long-lasting plan that's going to show you change over time.
I want to thank Roosevelt Burrell for joining us. Roosevelt, thanks for taking the time to share your story. I appreciate it.
Thank you as well. And I appreciate the good work that Lindsay is doing, and I applaud you. Keep up the good work.
Thanks for that.
Thank
yeah,
you.
We're going to continue our conversation with Lindsay in just a minute. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st.
The 21st is made possible by the Friends of WILL and by the Library at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, generating new knowledge and developing and evaluating new technologies and methodologies to better distribute scholarly knowledge. The University Library at Illinois.
Welcome back to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Thanks for tuning in. We've been talking about healthcare in Illinois' prison system. My guest is a staff attorney with the ACLU of Illinois, Lindsay Miller. The ACLU has actually sued the Department of Corrections on behalf of several inmates, saying that standards of medical care at state prisons are so poor that they're unconstitutional. Last month, a judge approved that lawsuit as a class action. We're talking about whether the results could force the Department of Corrections to overhaul care at dozens of facilities. Again, a note to our audience, we invited the Department of Corrections to join this conversation. They declined and basically said outside of court filings, they have nothing to add about health care in their facilities. Lindsay, before the break, you were just talking about sort of systemic changes that need to be made. In particular, you mentioned vacancies. Can you elaborate that on a little bit more in terms of what vacancies need to be filled?
Sure. In any, there are 26 facilities throughout IDOC, and for a medical team, there are three primary leadership vacancies: a medical director, a healthcare unit administrator, and director of nursing. And these are the fundamental positions for any healthcare system. They keep the system going. And as you mentioned earlier, there were experts that were appointed in our case to visit several facilities and do an investigation and report back on their findings. And several facilities were lacking these key critical leadership positions. Notably, at the time when the experts visited, Dixon Correctional Center, which has a really special mission within the system. It houses most of the older inmates throughout the system.
Right, because you mentioned the population is also aging.
Correct.
When we say aging, what do you mean? Do you mean 70s, 80s?
55 and older.
Okay.
Is kind of how we define the geriatric population. And Dixon has kind of a special role there where it houses most of them. And Dixon happened to not have any of those leadership positions filled. And that's something that we see happening throughout the system. You know, positions, they come and go. There's a high turnover. And there really needs to be some stability in those positions if any system is going to improve.
You also mentioned rewriting policies. What do you mean by that? What needs to be rewritten specifically?
Sure. So one example is policies related to the care of those with chronic illnesses. The experts found that there was kind of a cookie cutter model to these policies where people with chronic illnesses were scheduled to be seen 3 times a year, regardless of how well their diseases were being controlled. And the expert recommended that this needs to be changed. People should be evaluated and their future appointments should be based upon how well they're doing at that time. If, you know, they're deteriorating, then they need to be seen more frequently. So this is just a kind of backwards way of treating chronic illnesses. Another policy that needs to be developed is infirmary care. We've seen instances where prisons don't know the line of when an inmate can be treated in an infirmary versus needing to be sent to the hospital. In one instance, there was an inmate who was sent to the infirmary who was experiencing progressive paralysis throughout his lower body, and it was happening very rapidly. And they kept the inmate in the infirmary for 2 weeks before sending them to the hospital. And at this point, this inmate's permanently wheelchair-bound. So policies really need to be developed to say, okay, once we're seeing certain signs that we cannot control in this setting, we need to get these inmates to a hospital where they can receive the proper care.
What's next with this lawsuit? Last month, judge ruled that it could be class action. What's next for you all for the ACLU?
Right. So now we do have a class certified. So we represent all inmates throughout the entire system that have serious medical and dental care needs. And we will be going back in front of the court next week, and we will be pushing this case aggressively towards trial. We think that we need relief for our clients, and we want to get a system in place, and we want it moving as quickly as possible.
Lindsay Miller is a staff attorney with the ACLU of Illinois, joining us to talk more about their lawsuit against the Illinois Department of Corrections. Lindsay, thanks for being with me. I appreciate it.
Absolutely. Thank you.
All this week on the 21st, we've been talking about the national opioid epidemic and how it affects Illinois. Yesterday, we learned about how state funding cuts over the past decade, coupled with the ongoing budget impasse, has forced agencies across Illinois to reduce services or shut down entirely. All the while, fatal doses, overdoses have increased for every age group and race in the state of Illinois. That's according to data from the Illinois Department of Public Health. They're going to be joining us tomorrow. Today, we're going to be taking a closer look at what treatment and recovery looks like. In a few minutes, we'll be joined by two clinicians who work on the front lines, helping patients overcome addiction to opioids and prescription pain medications. But first, we wanted to bring you a personal story. In this case, a man who spent the past several years of his life battling an addiction to opioids. His name is Sam Workmeister. He's a resident of Granite City in the Metro East St. Louis area. He shared a story with St. Louis Public Radio's reporter, Deree Buscarin, last month.
I first actually used smoked pot when I was 9 years old, and then it progressed, you know, in the teenage years to smoking weed every day and drinking and using different types of drugs, experimenting with those. And it wasn't about until I was age 18 or 19 I began experimenting with prescription pain pills, opiates, Vicodins to be more specific, oxycodone, and then eventually about the age of 25, I was doing heroin. It was a lot more available, and it's cheaper, and it's more powerful than the prescription Vicodins and oxycodone. And they actually have some stuff out, some synthetic fentanyl out called, I believe it's called carfentanil, and it's really cheap, $5 for a cap. The button, they'd call it, is just a small dose of it, and it's it destroyed my life.
Sam's road to recovery has been long and difficult. He's been in and out of treatment several times.
There's many times I tried quitting on my own, thinking I just had to stop using. I could just quit on my own if I had enough willpower. I didn't know it was actually a disease. I didn't believe that concept to begin with. I just thought it was a moral deficiency. And I got tired of hurting the people that I love, my family and my kids. And it got to the point where I would steal from my own kids their Christmas money to get high. I hated doing it. I couldn't look at myself in the mirror, but, I mean, I couldn't stop, stealing from them their Christmas money. I mean, stealing from my own mother, her bank account, and just telling myself every day, this is the last time, Sam, you're going to do this. You cannot do this anymore. I just felt like crap over it. It was hell.
Sam says what really made a difference was going through a 28-day residential treatment program at Chestnut Health Systems in Bloomington in 2013. As of April, he's been sober for 2 months.
As many lies that drugs are taking right now, there needs to be a lot more facilities because people need to know, because they're hopeless at that time. They don't know. There is a way out of addiction. There is. Going to treatment had built the foundation of my recovery, and it helped me understand myself and some of the reasons why I used, and it introduced me to support groups, and what it most importantly did, it gave me hope that it can be done. You can recover. We do recover. There is a way out of addiction. My hope came back. I have self-esteem again. I could hold a job down. I could be active in my kids' lives, care what they're doing. And today I'm a functioning member of society, and it can be done.
That's Sam Workmeister. Thanks to St. Louis Public Radio's Jury Buscarin for that audio. To learn more about addiction treatment and recovery, I'm joined on the line now from Chicago by Dr. Rene Raffian, Chief Medical Officer of Gateway Foundation. And on the line from Granite City, Brent Cummings is the Director of Adult Addiction Treatment and Recovery Support at Chestnut Health Systems. Gentlemen, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being with me.
Hi, Nyla. Thank you for the invitation. Pleasure to be on.
Thank you as well. Yep.
Yeah, thanks both of you. As you heard Sam share his story, he went from prescription pain medications, well, actually, as he's talked about, even as a child, starting at age 9 with heroin, but then prescription pain medications to heroin, and then eventually stronger synthetic opioids. Dr. Raffian, is that the common progression for many people who become addicted?
What Sam's story and history is so common. I see this day in and day out. It is interesting that, and actually if you look at this age of onset, he started using pot at age 9. And he said it gradually progressed to alcohol and other experimental drugs. And by 18 and 19, started using prescription pills. And it is a very common pathway. Prescription painkillers are a very common pathway to heroin use. And it's interesting that heroin use is actually at epidemic proportions. 10 years ago, methamphetamine was epidemic. Now we see 18 to 25-year-olds with heroin addiction, which actually even 30 years ago, we never saw this age population using heroin. So his story is very typical as of how patients end up on heroin.
And when you're talking about epidemic levels, Dr. Raffian, is that something that you were seeing across Illinois? That's across the country. I think people probably seen those headlines. Can you give us a sense of, if you have any sense of over the past year, is that getting better or worse?
It is actually getting worse. If you look at the national trends, and it's not only Illinois, it's a national trend that overdose deaths due to opiate addiction is on the rise, and they continue to increase dramatically.
And Brent, what do you see with Chestnut Health Systems, with the folks that are coming into you're in the Metro East St. Louis area?
we definitely see the same here next to St. Louis. Clients are continuing to, unfortunately, overdose and die from this fatal disease. So clients are routinely calling in, needing services, and we get them in as quickly as we can.
Dr. Ruffian, I wonder if you can explain what makes addiction to opioids different from addiction to other drugs?
Well, you know, addiction is actually addiction across the board, and it is a disease. The problem that we face with opiates are many of them, for example, heroin is a short-acting, short half-life drug, so it needs to be taken frequently. And when problem with general opiates are that they are physically addicting as well. So when patients stop taking it, they go through significant physical withdrawal symptoms. And just to understand the severity of the withdrawal symptom, if someone is using heroin and they run out and they're not unable to get it, imagine your worst case of flu and multiply it by 10. That's how sick they feel. So it is not just about getting the drug to get high. For many patients, it is about getting the drug so they can avoid getting sick. So that's one part that is different from a cocaine addiction or a cannabis addiction.
Brent, I wonder also what else you've seen in your experience that people who aren't familiar with this might know about what makes addiction to opioids different.
Yeah, the doctor summed it up very, very well in that a person feels very sick. I've also heard clients report that it's as bad as the worst flu they've ever had. He said times 10. I've heard people say even worse than that, unfortunately. They begin to use not because it's giving them any kind of positive feeling anymore, but just to use to avoid negative feelings and symptoms. So many of them are seeking help and wanting help. It's just that they're not able to quit the substance without professional help that we can provide.
And I wonder, Brent, if I can ask you what you think are some common misconceptions about opioid treatment when it comes to treatment and recovery. What misconceptions do you think people have?
Sure. One of the bigger ones right now is that most of the research supports something called medication-assisted treatment. So there's typically three types of medication for the treatment of opioid addiction. That's usually methadone, something called buprenorphine, and injectable naltrexone. And what these medications do is they work similarly to the opioids the client might be using, but they produce a little bit of a weaker effect. The antagonists, such as Vivitrol, works by blocking the opioid receptors in the brain altogether so that opioids have a diminished or completely eliminate the effect on them. And so what that helps the client do then is engage in behavioral-type treatment that we can provide, group counseling, individual counseling, and actually focus on the work that they need to do to help them with overall recovery.
Dr. Ruffian, how important is, we just have about a minute before the break, and I'll get into the medications after that, but how important are treatment programs in terms of support groups and those sorts of things to someone's recovery?
It is the essential part of it. Without treatment, unfortunately, patients are frequently unsuccessful. Sam's story again sums it up. He said that he tried many times to stop on his own. And unfortunately, general belief is that addiction is about willpower, and one should be able to tell themselves to stop using. And it's just the character deficiency. Without treatment, without the basic treatment, patients are frequently unsuccessful, and it perpetuates the drug use.
And would you say it's also even, it sounds like, unsafe for someone to try to go through a withdrawal on their own?
It is unsafe, for example, in cases of alcohol withdrawal. Alcohol withdrawal can be deadly, and many patients do not know that, and they decide to stop drinking overnight, and they go through significant withdrawal symptoms.
And the same thing for opioids?
With opiates, if it's severe withdrawal, yes, it can compromise the patient significantly.
We're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to continue this conversation. My guests are Brent Cummings. He's the Director of Adult Addiction Treatment and Recovery Support at Chestnut Health Systems. We're also speaking with the Chief Medical Officer of the Gateway Foundation, Dr. Rureen Ruffian. And as always, you're welcome to join our conversation. Tweet to 21st Show. That's our handle, 21ST Show, with your questions or comments, or give us a call, 1-800-222-9455. We'll continue this conversation in just a minute.
The 21st is made possible by Kester & Bradley, LLP, providing legal services to the Urbana-Champaign community and Illinois residents since 1895. Kester & Bradley's attorneys are committed to achieving the best results for their clients. More information is available at KesterLawLLP.com.
Thanks for tuning in to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. All this week, we're talking about Illinois' opioid epidemic. Fatal overdoses have increased for every age group and race in the state of Illinois. That's according to data from the Illinois Department of Public Health. Tomorrow, we'll be speaking to its director, Dr. Nirav Shah, about how the Illinois Department of Public Health is addressing this very important issue. My guests right now are Dr. Rureen Ruffian. He's the Chief Medical Officer of Gateway Foundation, one of the largest nonprofit substance abuse treatment centers in Illinois. They run 13 centers, including several residential facilities. We also have the Director of Adult Addiction Treatment and Recovery Support for Chestnut Health Systems with me as well, Brent Cummings, on the line from Granite City. I should mention, if you or someone you know needs help, the National Helpline for Substance Abuse and Mental Health is 1-800-662-HELP. We've also been hearing the story of Sam Workmeister. We've been hearing little pieces of his individual story. And I wanted to hear a description from Sam. He describes what it was like to be told he had to wait a couple of weeks before his treatment could begin.
That takes a lot of time and a lot of courage just to build up that little bit of willingness. And you're told that you can't go. That could be the death of you, really. I mean, that you can go out and use and not live that night over it.
That's Sam Workmeister. When a person decides to seek professional help and they're told there's a weeks-long or even months-long waiting list, Brent, how does that affect their prospects in terms of overcoming their addiction?
It's discouraging. Like we've been talking about, with the state of Illinois, there's not enough treatment beds, unfortunately, to provide the residential type services that Sam was ultimately able to get that helped. What we do in this situation is begin starting them in outpatient treatment or intensive outpatient treatment immediately to engage them on that level and provide, hopefully, the medication-assisted treatment as well concurrently with group counseling, individual counseling, and then work toward getting them into residential as quickly as possible.
Dr. Ruffian, Sam described his first treatment was a 3-day medical detox, and then later he went through a longer-term residential treatment. I wonder for you all with Gateway Foundation, how are you finding that your services, whether they're for detox or for residential programs, are you finding yourself overwhelmed because so many other places in Illinois have had a tough time because of the state funding situation?
Well, you know, the state funding definitely affects all of us. Of course, it makes providing the services tougher and in multiple levels. So what Sam describes is very typical. When a patient decides to go into treatment, that's the time that we really, really need to get them into treatment. Any delay in that process can result in actually loss of the patient, because especially with opiates, they can overdose and die in every time that they use. So it's a fatal addiction. It's a fatal disease, and I want to underline the disease. So when a patient is ready to go into treatment, we have to be able to get them into appropriate level of care. And of course, with budgetary cuts, it makes it more difficult to get patients into appropriate level of care. And what is the appropriate level of care? Initially is detox. They have to be detoxed in a safe environment that is has the experience to detox patients, and followed by a residential treatment component. And why residential? Because patients do need time away from their environment, from their triggers, to be able to focus on themselves and establish some basic coping techniques and learn some skills how to not relapse once they leave. And I will, if you have a few minutes, I would like to talk a little bit more about the concept of addiction as a disease.
Mm-hmm. Please
do. It's a common misconception that addiction is something in the patient's power to be able
their
to
their willpower,
overcome.
You mean?
Their willpower, exactly.
But you just, so is it the sense that you think people think you just have to decide to stop using something and then that's how it works?
And that's how it works. However, if we actually look at the addiction circuitry in the brain, it is located close to our midbrain, which is part of our very, many of our autonomic responses, and such as body temperature regulation, breathing center. It is very primal, I should say. So when someone gets addicted, and there is a large number of research and evidence that the brain starts functioning in a different way. It is my analogy is diabetes. So if someone gets, if I get diagnosed with diabetes today, I have to make some lifestyle changes. I have to monitor my diet. I have to check my blood sugar a couple of times a day. I have to go see my doctor on a regular basis, and I have to take medications. If I do all of those, I get my blood sugar under control. Addiction treatment is very similar to that, which means, as a diabetic, does it mean that my blood sugar is not going to spike? Yes, it can spike, but if it spikes, you get me back in treatment. Unfortunately, again, our approach to addiction is if an addict relapses, then that's the end of the day. So if it is a disease, they need treatment, they need to come to treatment and get on the right track. Are there going to be slips? Yes, slips may happen, but it's important to get them back into the treatment. So at Gateway, we have a very medical model towards addiction treatment, which helps many patients understand why they have been so unsuccessful trying to stop on their own.
Yeah, thanks for sharing that, Dr. Raffi, and I appreciate it. Brent, I wonder if there's something about the language that we use around addiction that you think we could be better at to, as Dr. Raffi is sort of talking about the fact that talking about it as a disease, I wonder from a language standpoint, are there better ways we should be describing this to more accurately reflect what people are going through?
Yeah, I think so. I think looking at language that's more person-centered, a lot of people will just look at this situation as if we just, you know, are dealing with people that are addicts, and we need to look at it as an individual who's struggling with a substance use disorder, you know, and looking at the individual first and identifying that these people didn't choose this sort of lifestyle. They initially use for a variety of different reasons. I mean, we get clients that have done something as simple as gotten a wisdom tooth pulled, and they were provided with numerous amounts of hydrocodone or oxycodone or things of that nature and got hooked on it and then started using heroin potentially because it was cheaper and whatnot to take care of. So in a lot of situations, they're now addicted at that point and need our help, need our services to get better and get back on their feet. So it's really important. It's important to instill hope and let them know that there's treatment resources out there like Chestnut and Gateway that can provide services to get them back to where they need to go.
And I also wonder, Dr. Raffian, can you explain how many years it takes on average for a person or how many attempts, rehab attempts it normally takes for someone to successfully no longer be free from an opioid addiction?
Well, you know, it is hard to say because it is such an individual and it differs from one person to another. It depends on a number of factors. It depends on duration of use, age of onset, support factors, their commitment to recovery. addressing their comorbid medical and psychiatric issues. And that's another important aspect of substance abuse treatment, as some patients have significant history of trauma. They could have a major depressive disorder. They could suffer with bipolar disorder. If the comorbid psychiatric and medical conditions are not simultaneously addressed, of course, it's naive to anticipate the patients are going to remain in recovery. So it is a pretty much a multi-pronged approach. If all of those are addressed and the patients are willing to stick with the treatment and adhere to meetings and recovery, success rate is pretty high. Actually, relapse rates are very in addiction are less than relapse rate in hypertension and diabetes with successful treatment.
Oh, wow. So I wonder, as you're talking about support groups, I wanted to play one final piece from Sam, who we've been hearing from his story. He actually talked about how critical it's been for him to have a support group, Narcotics Anonymous. That's from let's hear from Sam Workmeister.
When I hear someone's experience and they share their strength and their hope with me, it helps me stay clean. Like I said, it helped me realize that I'm not alone. And I admit that I cannot do this on my own.
Brent, how important are long-term support groups, counseling, groups like Narcotics Anonymous to continued success?
Very critical. Cravings for opioid addiction can last for several years. So the activities that are learned in treatment that you pick up and you learn to cope with the withdrawal are all important in your routine. So this, you know, the things like exercise, yoga, getting to 12-step meetings and attending those help kind of manage those cravings, and it gets them looking at their routine and schedule and following something that helps them avoid thinking or using.
Dr. Raffian, I wanted to ask you about something. You were talking about the circuitry of our brains and how much, particularly heroin, other opiates, can affect and alter that circuitry. What kind of impact does it have on a younger brain, on, for example, a teenager who starts using?
Well, definitely the data is coming out regarding the effect of drugs on the younger brains. We have significant data, actually, from cannabis use in teenage years, and there are two large studies. One is a British study, and another one is a study done in New Zealand, which actually was a long-term study following patients over 30 years. So both of these studies showed the same results. And in the scientific world, when you can replicate results of one study a second time, there is significant scientific validity. And that showed for patients who started using cannabis prior to age 18 in teen years, even if they did stop using after 18, on average, by the time they were 30, and the patients who started using in younger age around 12 and 13, there was a 10-point reduction in their IQ.
10 points. So, wow.
10 points. That's a lot of IQ points to lose. So the developing brain is susceptible. So it does make a significant impact on the brain structure itself. And also what we see on the psychological level in addiction treatment world, we are all familiar with it, and I think Brent can talk to this about this as well, that once patients start using, they stop developing healthy coping skills. So the younger they start using, the lower are their coping skills, because use becomes a way of coping with whatever unpleasant affect or unpleasant thought that we may experience. So it gets tougher for these patients to actually start learning how to cope with life's adversities.
Brent, can I ask, from what you're seeing, we just have about a minute left here, do you think this problem is getting worse? I've seen some reports that maybe in central Illinois we're seeing numbers plateau. What's your sense on the ground?
A lot of it might be regional. I mean, we're, like I said, in the Metro East here, close to St. Louis. You know, things continue to be a concern. We had over 90 people in just my county alone in Madison County die of overdose last year. In Missouri, they continue to not pass a drug monitoring program for prescription opioids. St. Louis, they've passed something, but overall in the state of Missouri, that's still the only state in the United States that doesn't have something like that. So we do get clients potentially that go over there and doctor shop a little bit to get various opioids and come back across the river. So it's a challenge. We're up to it, though. We're going to continue to fight it, look at ways that we can learn from research and whatnot to reach these clients and get them the help they need, though.
I want to thank Brent Cummings, the Director of Adult Addiction Treatment and Recovery Support at Chestnut Health Systems, also Dr. Ruine Raffian, the Chief Medical Officer from the Gateway Foundation, for helping us understand a little bit more about addiction treatment and recovery. Gentlemen, thank you for being with me.
Oh, it was a pleasure. Thank you, Nyla, and thank Brent.
My pleasure, yeah. Thank you.
I should add again, if you or someone you know needs help, the National Helpline for Substance Abuse and Mental Health is 1-800-662-HELP. Coming up on tomorrow's program, we're going to continue our conversation on the opioid crisis by asking the director of the Illinois Department of Public Health what he's doing from a public health perspective. We're also going to be speaking with Congressman Randy Holmgren from Illinois' 14th Congressional District in Northern Illinois about what he's doing. That does it for us today. Thanks for tuning in. You can always find past shows on the NPR One app. Search for The 21st. We're also available on iTunes and Android. All of that information's at our website, 21stshow.org. I'm Nyla Boodoo. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks for listening.